So, I want you to try a little experiment with me here. Look around the room you're in right now and just pick an object.
Any object.
Yeah, any object. A table, a coffee mug, maybe the phone in your hand. Now, I'm going to ask you a question that sounds, incredibly simple, but if we do this right, it might actually break your brain a little bit. Is that object real?
Oh, wow, that is a dangerous question to start a morning with.
I know, right? But seriously, think about it. Is the world you are seeing made of solid, unbreakable truths? Is that table just a table? Or, and bear with me here, is your reality basically a construction project?
Like a mental construction project.
Exactly. Is it a massive pile of tiny logical Lego bricks that your brain is just frantically snapping together every millisecond to create the illusion of a table?
It is a really provocative image because,
Right.
we tend to walk through life thinking the world is just given to us. It's there, it's whole, it's complete.
Right, you stub your toe on it, it's
Yeah,
real.
exactly.
Yeah.
But if we really look under the hood of human thought, which is exactly what we are doing today, it turns out our reality might be much more about assembly than we realize.
And that is exactly where we are going today. We are doing a deep dive into the mind of one of the 20th century's absolute intellectual giants. We're talking about Bertrand Russell.
And specifically, we are looking at his philosophy, which is known as logical atomism.
Which, I mean, sounds like a physics term, doesn't it?
It really does. But it isn't about splitting uranium, it is about splitting thoughts. It was essentially a quest for purity. Russell wanted to see if we could turn philosophy into a rigorous scientific system.
Because, let's be honest, philosophy is often just people arguing about their feelings in a smoky room.
That is a fair critique of a lot of it, yeah. Russell wanted to fix that. He wanted to make philosophy look and function like mathematics.
He wanted to stop the guessing game and start the calculating game. So, to guide us through this, we are digging into a fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes. He covers the history of philosophy, specifically walking us through this massive shift from the 19th century way of thinking into the 20th century analytic style.
The analytic style that Russell effectively helped invent.
Right. And the mission for this deep dive is to understand that exact journey. We're going to see how Russell tried to build a perfect, airtight, logical language to describe the universe.
And this is the part that I think makes the whole story so incredibly human. We are going to see where he eventually hit a massive wall.
Spoiler alert for everyone listening, it doesn't end quite as neatly as he hoped. It is almost a tragedy of logic. But before we get to Russell himself, Dr. Holmes makes a great point. He says we can't just drop a paratrooper into Russell's brain.
No, you have to look backward
We
first.
have to set the stage. We need to look at the grandfathers of this way of thinking.
Right, because Russell didn't just invent this scientific urge out of thin air. He inherited it. You really cannot understand Bertrand Russell without understanding the 19th century empiricism that he was reacting to and honestly building upon.
So, who are these grandfathers?
Dr. Holmes highlights three key figures here. You have Auguste Comte from France, John Stuart Mill from Britain, and Ernst Mach, who is an Austrian-German thinker.
And there's a weirdly personal connection here, too, isn't there? I found this part fascinating.
There is, yeah. It's a great bit of philosophical trivia. John Stuart Mill, who was one of the most famous philosophers of the 19th century, was actually Bertrand Russell's godfather.
Which I found hilarious because, as the source points out, neither of these men were exactly the church on Sunday types.
Oh, far from it. Godfather was definitely a loose secular term in their case. There wasn't much religion involved at all.
But spiritually, or I guess intellectually, Mill was absolutely his father.
Completely. Russell was literally born into this specific lineage of radical empiricism. It was in his intellectual DNA.
So, what was the actual vibe of this lineage? What were these three grandfathers trying to do that was so utterly different from the guys who came before them?
Well, basically, they were entirely tired of armchair philosophy. For centuries, you had these brilliant thinkers like Descartes trying to figure out the fundamental truths of the universe just by sitting alone in a room.
Just thinking really hard until they figured it out.
Right. Thinking really hard until they found what they called a first principle. But Mill, Comte, and Mach came along and said, no, that era is over. They wanted to shift from rationalism, which is just thinking about it, to empiricism.
Which is actually testing it, getting
Yeah.
your hands dirty with real data.
Precisely. And Russell inherited three specific pillars of thought from these men. If you want to think like Bertrand Russell, you really need to understand these three tools. The first one is something called the hypothetico-deductive method.
Which is, I have to say, a massive mouthful.
It is a terrible name for a really elegant concept. It's just a simple shift in how we seek truth. Old-school philosophy wanted foundationalism. They wanted to start with an absolute, undeniable truth.
Like Descartes saying, I think, therefore I am.
Exactly like that. And from that absolute truth, they wanted to deduce everything else, sort of like you would write out a geometric proof. But the empiricists realized that finding those absolute, undeniably true starting points is almost impossible in the real world.
So what are you supposed to do instead? Do you just guess?
Kind of. You make a hypothesis.
Okay.
The source uses a really great analogy to explain this shift. Imagine you want to know what a class of students is like. Maybe you want to know their average height or their general political views.
Okay, I'm with you.
But you only have the time or resources to survey half the class.
So I get data on exactly 50% of them.
Right. Now, logically, you cannot say for a verified fact that the entire class matches that 50%. You just don't know that for sure.
Right. The other half could be completely different.
Exactly. But you could make a hypothesis. You say, I am going to assume the whole class matches my empirical sample. And then you proceed as if that hypothesis is true.
So the whole endeavor of science stops being about proving absolute foundational truth, and it starts being about testing really strong assumptions.
That is the big shift, yeah. It becomes probabilistic, not absolute. And that perfectly sets up the second pillar they gave him, which is the unity of science. This one comes largely from Auguste Comte.
This is the idea that absolutely everything should be treated like physics, right?
Pretty much. Comte truly believed that the rigorous methods of natural science, things like physics and chemistry, shouldn't just stay locked in the laboratory. They should apply to absolutely everything human beings do.
Like sociology, political science, history.
Yes. He thought we could and should study human society with the exact same rigor that we study falling rocks or chemical reactions.
Which perfectly explains why we call them the social sciences today. I guess that must have been a highly revolutionary idea back then.
It was incredibly radical. They wanted to take the messy, emotional, unpredictable human experience and subject it to universal laws. And that leads us to the third pillar, which is arguably the most crucial one for Russell.
Let me guess, phenomenalism.
That's the one. Or, if you want a more descriptive name, you could call it anti-metaphysics.
Ah, right. This is what we were calling the no-ghosts rule.
Yes, the no-ghosts rule. They firmly believed that human inquiry eventually outgrows religion, and then it outgrows metaphysics. They didn't want to talk about hidden essences or spirits or underlying forms.
John Stuart Mill actually had this famous definition of matter that the lecture brings up, which I thought was brilliant.
Oh, the permanent possibility of sensation.
Yes. He said matter isn't some mystical substance holding the universe together. It is simply the permanent possibility of sensation. It is such a dry phrase, yet it's so accurate.
It perfectly encapsulates the empiricist mindset.
It's like saying, this table I'm sitting at isn't a magical object with an essence of tableness. It is just a physical guarantee that if I punch it right here, my hand is going to hurt.
Exactly. It is literally just a promise of future data. That is all matter is.
Mm.
And that is the intellectual vibe that Russell inherits. He wants to make all of philosophy factual, intensely scientific, and entirely free of mystical fluff.
But Russell brings something entirely new to the party, doesn't he? He wasn't just a traditional philosopher. He started his career as a mathematician.
And a brilliant one at that.
And this is where it gets really interesting for me. Russell doesn't just want to talk about the world in a scientific way. He actually wants to calculate it. So he teams up with Alfred North Whitehead to write this massive, legendary book.
Principia Mathematica, or PM, as it's known in the trade.
Dr. Holmes actually had a pretty funny bit about that in the lecture. He said, over in Britain, the letters PM can really only mean three things.
Right, the afternoon, the prime minister, or Principia Mathematica.
Which really gives you a sense of the cultural weight this book had. Now, the core argument of Principia Mathematica, and correct me if I'm off here, is that mathematics is logic.
You're spot on. They argued that math isn't some separate mystical realm of numbers. It is simply a formal deductive system. You start with basic axioms and you logically deduce absolutely everything else from there.
I remember reading somewhere that in Principia, it takes them something absurd, like 360 pages, just to mathematically prove that 1 + 1 = 2.
That is completely true.
Yeah.
Because they weren't taking anything for granted. They weren't assuming you just knew what one was. They were meticulously building the logical floorboards of the entire universe from scratch.
That is wild.
And Russell's ambition was huge. He looked at what they did with math and thought, well, if we can do this for numbers, why can't we do it for language? Why can't we do it for all human thought?
He wanted to create a universal symbolic language to analyze absolutely everything. No more vague poetry, no more smoky rooms, just pure, unbreakable logic. And this brings us to the main event of our deep dive.
Logical atomism.
Right. So I want you to imagine the Lego analogy we started the show with. Russell essentially believed that if you take any complex thought or any complex object in the world, you can smash it apart until you get to the tiny, unbreakable pieces.
The atoms.
The atoms. Not physical atoms, but logical ones.
Exactly. In his view, there are what he calls atomic facts. These are the absolute smallest units of reality. They are the base constituents of the universe. And mathematically corresponding to them are atomic propositions.
Which are the smallest units of speech.
Right. The smallest, simplest claims you can make that assert or deny something.
Okay, so if I say the cat is on the mat, is that an atomic fact?
Actually, no. That is what he would call a molecular proposition.
Because it's made of smaller parts.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have a cat, you have a mat, and you have a spatial relationship between them. Russell wants to break that down even further. He wants to violently strip away the confusion and shorthand of everyday language to find the raw logical skeleton hiding underneath.
Okay, I think I need a concrete example of how this actually works because this gets pretty abstract. Dr. Holmes used a classic example from Russell in the lecture that I found, frankly, kind of maddening at first.
Ooh, you mean the King of France?
But yes, the King of France. So the sentence Russell analyzes is, "The present King of France is bald."
This is an incredibly famous example in philosophy circles.
But here is my issue with it. France is a republic. There is no present King of France. So obviously the sentence is just completely wrong. Why does a genius like Bertrand Russell spend pages and pages analyzing a sentence about a guy who literally doesn't exist?
Because it is a logic trap. It exposes a flaw in how we use language. Think about it this way. If I look at you and say, the present King of France is bald, and you reply, well, that's false. What are you logically implying by saying it's false?
I guess I'm implying that he isn't bald.
Right, because logic usually works in strict binaries. If the statement he is bald is false, then the opposite statement he has hair logically should be true.
But wait, there is no king. So the statement the King of France has hair is also entirely false.
Exactly. You have a scenario where both the statement and its exact opposite are totally false.
Oh, I see.
It breaks what logicians call the law of excluded middle. It is basically a ghost sentence. It sounds grammatically correct. It seems to have meaning, but it completely crashes the logical system. And Russell absolutely hated that.
Because he wanted a system where everything is definitively true or definitively false with zero ghosts.
Exactly. So how does he fix it? How does logical atomism solve the bald king problem?
He essentially performs surgical analysis on the sentence. He says, look, the King of France is bald looks like one simple, straightforward fact, but it is actually three atomic claims wearing a trench coat pretending to be one sentence.
Let's unmask them. What are the three claims?
Okay, claim one. There exists an X such that X is the King of France. Claim two, there is only one X. And claim three, this X is bald.
Perfect. And because claim one asserts there exists an X and we can empirically look at the world and see that there is no X,
the whole thing collapses immediately. The entire molecular proposition is false. Not because the imaginary king has a full head of hair, but simply because the very first atomic brick is missing from reality.
There is no ambiguity. There are no logic-breaking ghosts. It is just structurally false.
That is incredibly meticulous. I mean, it's almost exhaustingly detailed, but I guess that is exactly the point. He is trying to forcibly clean up the messiness of human language.
Precisely. And he called this the correspondence theory of truth. He argued that truth only ever exists when your atomic statement corresponds on a perfect one-to-one basis with an atomic fact out there in the real world. If the pieces don't snap together perfectly like Legos, it simply is not true.
Okay, so we have a universe that is made entirely of these atomic facts. But this naturally brings up a much bigger, slightly terrifying question. What are these facts actually made of? Are they physical matter? Are they thoughts?
This is where we get into the really heavy stuff, the metaphysics.
Right. And Russell's answer to this is actually quite unique. The lecture explains that he is a pluralist regarding quantity.
Meaning he thinks the world is made of billions and billions of separate, distinct little facts.
Yes, but regarding quality, meaning what those facts actually are fundamentally, he is a monist.
Right, meaning absolutely everything is made of the exact same stuff.
Correct. But here is the massive kicker. He doesn't think that stuff is mind, like idealists do, and he doesn't think it is physical matter, like materialists do. He calls his theory neutral monism.
Neutral monism. I have to say, that sounds remarkably like a Switzerland policy for philosophy.
In a way, it really is. He is flat out refusing to take sides in the classic mind-body debate. He suggests that the raw fundamental stuff of the universe is completely neutral. It isn't mental and it isn't physical until we group it together in a specific way.
That is genuinely hard to wrap my head around. If this fundamental stuff isn't physical and it isn't mental, what is it?
He argues it is just events, occurrences in space-time. Think of it like a deck of playing cards. The cards themselves are neutral. They are just printed cardboard. If you deal them and arrange them one way, you are playing poker. If you arrange them an entirely different way, you are playing bridge.
Okay, I follow that. The cards don't fundamentally change, just the logical arrangement changes.
Exactly. So matter is just one specific logical arrangement of this neutral stuff. And mind, human consciousness, is simply another arrangement of those exact same neutral events.
So you're saying matter is just the logical construct we actively build out of these atomic facts, and mind is just another construct we build out of those very same facts.
That is exactly what he's saying. Dr. Holmes uses the searchlight analogy in the lecture, which he credits to William James and Russell, and it really helps visualize this abstract idea.
Oh, I really like this visual. Walk us through the searchlight.
Imagine a chain of physical events happening in total darkness. That chain is the neutral stuff of the universe, just events ticking along, causing other events. Now imagine a searchlight, which represents your conscious awareness sweeping across that dark space.
Okay, I'm picturing it. It's a dark room. Events are happening. The light sweeps over.
When that searchlight hits a specific section of that physical chain, that section lights up. Now, in that exact illuminated moment, that section is actually two things at once.
Two things at once.
Yes. It is a physical event because it is still an unbroken part of that dark chain. But it is also a mental event because it is actively being seen by the light.
That is so trippy. So the event itself isn't inherently mental or inherently physical. It's physical because it's situated in the causal chain of the world, and it's mental simply because it's currently in the light of awareness.
Precisely. The mind isn't some separate, floating, ghostly substance. Mind is just the fact that the light happens to be on. It is the exact same neutral event, just functioning in two totally different logical contexts.
This naturally leads Russell to distinguish between two totally different types of knowledge, doesn't it? Because if absolutely everything is a construct we build, what do we actually know for sure?
Right. He makes a hard split. He distinguishes between what he calls knowledge by acquaintance and knowledge by description.
Let's define those. Knowledge by acquaintance is basically the raw data feed, right?
Yes. Direct awareness, unfiltered sense data. It's the raw experience of redness or the raw feeling of hardness before your brain even has a second to attach a name to it. That is the true atomic level of reality.
And absolutely everything else is just description.
Everything else is a construct. When you point and say, that is a table, that is knowledge by description, you don't actually physically experience tableness. You experience a flat shape, a brown color, a hard tactile sensation.
And your brain just frantically uses knowledge by description to glue those raw sensations together and slap the label table on it.
Exactly. So going all the way back to my opening question with the listener, when you look at the table in your room, you are not actually seeing a complete objective table. You are just seeing raw atomic data points, brown, flat, solid, and you are instantly building the rest of the concept yourself.
You are actively building your reality, logical brick by logical brick, every single second of the day.
I don't know about you, but that makes me feel completely exhausted just thinking about it.
It is a lot of mental heavy lifting.
But here's the really fascinating thing. Russell was trying to make this a perfect, flawless system. He wanted to explain the entirety of human existence and science this way. But Dr. Holmes mentions a massive twist at the end of the lecture. A pretty big one.
It really is the twist that haunts the end of Russell's career. It's almost heartbreaking if you are a fan of pure logic.
What exactly happened?
Well, later in his life, around 1948, he publishes a book called Human Knowledge, Its Scope and Limits. And in this book, he comes to a somewhat devastating conclusion for a guy who dedicated his life to pure empiricism.
He finally hits the wall.
He runs headfirst into the wall. He realizes that if you rely strictly on pure empiricism, meaning you refuse to believe anything except what you can rigorously verify with empirical samples and atomic facts, you actually cannot logically prove that science works.
Wait, pause right there. You are saying Bertrand Russell realized you cannot prove science works by using only science.
Not purely logically, no. Think about the induction problem we discussed earlier with the classroom survey.
Right, where you only survey half the kids.
Exactly. You can survey half the class, and you can get flawless empirical data on them. But you absolutely cannot logically deduce with perfect mathematical certainty that the other unsampled half is exactly the same. You just have to make a guess.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Russell realized that you cannot logically deduce the future from the past just by looking at a pile of atomic facts. Just because the sun rose 1,000 days in a row doesn't logically prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that it will rise tomorrow. There is no atomic fact sitting in the universe that guarantees the future will behave like the past.
So, let me get this straight. The man who spent his entire life trying to ruthlessly get rid of all the assumptions, all the metaphysics, and all the unprovable faith, he eventually realized he needs a little bit of faith.
Well, he certainly wouldn't ever call it faith. But practically speaking, yes. To save the entire enterprise of science, Russell had to forcefully introduce what he termed scientific postulates.
Postulates. I have to say, that sounds highly suspiciously like things we just have to quietly agree to pretend are true.
That is effectively exactly what they are. He listed a set of core principles that we absolutely must assume are true, just to make science function at all.
Oh, were they?
There are a few main ones. One, the principle of induction, which is the belief that patterns actually continue.
Even though we can't prove they will.
You're right. Two, the uniformity of nature, the assumption that physics works the exact same way on a distant galaxy as it does right here on Earth. Three, causal lines, the belief that one event actually causes the next one instead of them just randomly happening next to each other.
And what's the last one?
Four, the quasi-permanence of objects. The deeply held assumption that your coffee mug doesn't simply cease to exist the moment you close your eyes and stop observing it.
But these are the exact types of things he spent his early career aggressively trying to avoid. He tried to strip away every ounce of metaphysics, and in the end, he had to drag these massive metaphysical ghosts right back into the house just to keep the lights on.
It is a profoundly deep irony. Dr. Holmes points this out brilliantly in the lecture. By doing this, Russell basically completely validates the deep skepticism of David Hume from centuries earlier.
Remind me what Hume said.
Hume said, we can never logically prove causality or induction. We just believe in them because we have what he called animal faith. We biologically need to believe them just to survive in the world. Russell, after decades of the most complex math and logic ever attempted, basically sighs and says, yeah, you were right. We just need the postulates.
We absolutely need them to function as humans. I mean, if I didn't implicitly believe in the quasi-permanence of objects, I would be genuinely terrified to sit down in this chair because it might just vanish before I hit the cushion.
Exactly. We desperately need these beliefs to live our daily lives, and we need them to execute science. But, and this is the absolutely crucial takeaway, we simply cannot prove them using only pure logic and atomic facts.
That is just incredibly humbling. We started this whole deep dive with the grand mission of building a flawless mathematical description of the world. Russell, who is arguably one of the smartest people to ever live, tried his hardest to turn reality into a perfectly clean equation.
And he got impressively far.
He did, but he ended up having to admit that the equation literally doesn't work unless you plug in a few magic unprovable numbers that you just have to choose to believe in.
It really perfectly highlights the fundamental limits of human reason. We can endlessly analyze, we can meticulously dissect, we can ruthlessly reduce the physical world down to its raw atoms. But to actually put it all back together into a meaningful, functioning picture, we have to make a leap.
We have to construct a mental framework that goes way beyond the raw data.
I do.
So, as we wrap this up, what does all this abstract philosophy actually mean for you, the listener, right now? Maybe you're driving to work or doing the dishes. Why does this matter?
I think it radically changes how we view truth itself. We so often think of science as this cold, hard, completely independent collection of absolute facts sitting out there in the void. But Russell's journey shows us that even the most rigorously strict scientific worldview heavily relies on a hidden framework of assumptions that we actively construct.
We are active participants in building our understanding of the universe, not just passive security cameras recording it.
Exactly. To go back to that beautiful analogy, we are the searchlight. We provide the vital illumination that turns a dark chain of raw events into mind and matter.
That is a genuinely powerful thought. And I want to leave you with one final thought to just sort of chew on as you go about the rest of your day.
Let's hear it.
If our entire understanding of the physical world relies on these mental constructs and these completely unprovable postulates, how much of your daily reality is actually given to you, and how much are you simply building in your own head right at this very moment?
Are you actually seeing the objective world, or are you really just seeing your own detailed description of it?
Exactly. Take a look at that table again and question your atomic facts, everyone. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
It was an absolute pleasure.
See you next time.